Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. You're listening to a new The Hacker Factory podcast with hacker maker Philip Wiley. You're about to discover what the role of a professional hacker entails, the different specializations it holds, and what it takes to learn and become one. Enjoy the conversation as Philip and guests unveil the secrets of professional hacking, a mysterious, intriguing, and often misunderstood occupation. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
BugCrowd's award-winning platform combines actionable contextual intelligence with the skill and experience of the world's most elite hackers to help leading organizations identify and fix vulnerabilities, protect customers, and make the digitally connected world a safer place. Learn more at bugcrowd.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Hacker Factory podcast. I'm your host, the hacker maker, Philip Wiley. In each episode, I have a unique guest sharing their story of how they got started in the industry. And hopefully these stories will help you, encourage you, or help you get started in the industry. And today I'm really happy to bring on the show Rob Reagan. He was recommended from Brittany Kemp. And so it was kind of cool. Another guest that I had is a recommendation. My last guest was a recommendation. These are always fun because a lot of my guests, I know them from social media, kind of know their background. So it's always nice, just like, you know, making friends and meeting people the first time, getting to know about them. So as you're all getting to find out about Rob, I'm getting to learn about Rob myself. So welcome to the show, Rob.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule. I know a consultant's life can be very busy.
That's true. I tend to get pulled in a lot of directions, but things like this are really fun. I'm really excited that it all the stars aligned and we're able to make some time to connect.
Yeah, it's great to always have people that value community and helping others. And that's like, you know, Britt recommended you and she's one of those people, one of your community people there at Bishop Fox. So it's great for you to take the time. Some people, it's good when people value it and are able to give the time. I know not everyone has the time, but, you know, be able to make the time and prioritizing that thing to help others is a great thing. Because, you know, a lot of the goal of the podcast is to help others that are wanting to get started in the industry. An interesting thing is people will come up and ask, you know, they're 30 or 40 or 50 years old. Am I too old to get in the industry? And they're not, but they just don't realize this. And when people share their stories, then it's kind of a way to encourage them and prove them that it can be done. I like to make a lot of analogies to sports because it's like breaking records. You know, when someone breaks a record in a certain distance of a run, before they did that, no one was hitting it. But it seems like once someone breaks that record, everyone's doing it all of a sudden. It just took someone proving to them it could be done.
Yeah, they showed what was possible. And I completely agree. I think that helping the community, first of all, you know, big fan of podcasts. I think it's like a great way. I'm a much better listener as a way to learn probably than I am even with like reading. I think this is such a good venue for people to discover new information. And I think that you kind of hit the nail on the head with there's a lot of people that want to break into this industry and they're looking for guidance on how. And I'm just happy you invited me and happy that Britt was able to make the introduction because it really, you know, is a great way to share some stories. I've been in this industry for a while now, but I always was passionate about it first. I didn't even know you could do this for work or for like a career back when I first took an interest. And I think that as long as someone's passionate, they can learn. It doesn't matter how old they are. It doesn't matter like whatever they think is a roadblock. If they're passionate enough and persistent enough, that's really all they need to do.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. You know how passion can make up for a lot of things. You know, there's people that are more gifted. You know, some people just pick up things. They're just naturally intelligent, or they really studied a lot when they're younger and really developed that intelligence. But you know, I've seen people that have been really passionate that, you know, have achieved things that you would never guess.
That's not me. Not in the super intelligent camp.
Yeah, I'm same with you.
I definitely know a lot of people like that, though, and admire them and have learned a lot from them. Probably the smartest decision I made was to try to surround myself with people like that, so hoping that they rub off on me.
Well, at least one thing you got to say about that. When you know, they tell you not to be the smartest person in the room, I don't have to try too hard to do that. So,
yeah, no, I think there's something to finding really good mentors. And I was fortunate early on in my working career in cybersecurity to have some great mentors like Caleb Sima and Billy Hoffman. They really were kind enough to take me under their wing, whether they realized it or not. they just would put some things out there, and I just tried to pick up what they were putting down and really focus on it.
Yeah, could you kind of share with our listeners how you got started? Kind of your origin story?
Sure. How long do we have for this podcast? Because I can give you the long version and the short version.
Let's hear the long version. I think that's good, because okay. That way the listeners, because sometimes there's that one thing you might have skipped over that someone might have really picked up on.
Yeah, sure thing. So I had a childhood friend that I won't go into too much detail on the specifics, but we got into a lot of trouble together. And he showed me 2600.org. Which he specifically showed me the gallery of defaced websites. And I remember thinking, oh, that is just a great prank. I gotta learn how to do that. And I remember, finding 2600 magazine in like the local Borders bookstore where I grew up. And, this had just, anyone could submit an article. I love that it was more like a zine. It was anyone could send in to the publisher some information. You know, the great hacker zines like Frack and 2600, I'd say, were really influential on me early on. I was spending like my allowance money and my first job money on, you know, going and buying those and reading those. And in the back, there was a section that listed every major city where there were 2600 meetups. And I think I was in maybe high school at the time, and I was kind of begging my parents to go to these, even though it was down at the university's student union down in Pittsburgh where I grew up. And eventually, I got to go, and I think my coworker ended up driving me to one of these, and it blew my mind that there were just, you know, like-minded people that were, you know, into reading this 2600 magazine as well and learning about how to hack computers. And I'd always been interested in computers before that. Early on was, you know, learning how to build computers, how to install Linux, how to program, how to do network administration, system administration. But then security became like the hobby on top of that. I was like, oh, you really want to learn how you can kind of manipulate these systems to do whatever it is that you want them to do. And that was just, you know, it's like unlimited possibilities. I really got involved with the local 2600 chapter. Shout out to PA2600.org. You changed my life. We got together, we did presentations for each other. That's where I first learned how to manipulate memory, go into a disassembler and change like the assembly to affect the instructions. That's like we learned how to like crack software. I think the funny story is the first software I remember cracking, thanks to what they taught me, was actually Loftcrack. The professional version at that point, that if you wanted to do full brute forcing of passwords using Loftcrack, you had to buy it with a license. But I learned at a 2600 meeting how to bypass the license registration system by changing a JE to JNE in the assembly. Kind of fast forward, I met some really smart people, and they're some like really lifelong friends. One of them, he was a little bit older than me, and he had moved down to Atlanta for work. And I was, you know, going down there and visiting him. He kept trying to get me to drop out of college at that point and just get a job. But I decided to finish my degree. And I'm glad I did, but it was tempting to just drop out and go. But I was always like coming up with like ideas for companies. At that point I was working as a web developer for my university. I was writing like ASP.NET web apps mostly in C#. And, you know, security was still the hobby and the passion. So I had this idea. I was like, I told my buddy, I was like, we could crawl websites automatically and find vulnerabilities in them. And he's like, oh yeah, there's already a company here in Atlanta that does that. And I said, well, fine, I'd like to work for them. And, he gave me an introduction to get an interview, with a company called Spy Dynamics. And, I flew down and interviewed. It was pretty intense. They asked some tough questions, but they ended up making me an offer at the end of that day. And I gladly accepted it. And that was how I got my first job in the security space. And specifically, I joined a team where I was, my job was to write vulnerable web apps to test our static analysis tool. And so the static analysis tool was called DevInspect, way ahead of its time. It was like a Visual Studio plugin that would automatically, using IntelliSense, tell developers where they had vulnerable code and let them right click and then add a validator, or like basically fix the vulnerability. And unfortunately, this never really took off, but I do think that it was just ahead of its time. But my first job there was to write vulnerable web apps, specifically ASP.NET web apps, which I had a lot of experience with already just from being a web developer. And I got to learn all the wrong ways to code. That was my job. I got to basically study and learn all the ways to make a SQL injection vulnerability in the code, all the ways to make a cross-site scripting vulnerability in the code, all the ways to just have issues that our tool was supposed to help our customers find. And from there, I got into working with the dynamic analysis team. And I worked on the crawler. I worked on the vulnerability scanner engine. I also got to work on the enterprise version of the app, which was meant to take many, many of our web inspect engines and test hundreds or thousands of applications for like a large enterprise. This was also ahead of its time, I think, because you had to rack a server, license that server. This was all very expensive at that point. So this is long ago. At this point, I'm dating myself, is like 15 plus years ago. They also, when I was at Spy Dynamics, gave me my first taste of penetration testing. There was a conference that the founder of the company presented at after HP acquired the company. HP acquired the company not that long after I joined, but basically we got challenged by the CTO of a really well-known brand that, why do I need to care about application security? And they said, we have IDS, we have IPS, we have a top-notch network security team, but why do I need to care about application security? Like, prove it to me. Basically, the gauntlet was thrown down. The founder of the company put myself and about a dozen other people in a room, in a conference room, for 2 weeks with house music, Red Bull, and vodka, and said, do your worst. And we sent that CTO a retirement plaque from their HR system. And we found SQL injection to download images of checks that had bank accounts and routing numbers on them. We found ways to, I could go on. We found a lot of very critical vulnerabilities. Basically, proved why he should care about application security. And once I got a taste for that, I realized that there was this job that you could have called a professional penetration tester. Oh, I was hooked. I was like, wait. At that point, I thought I'd just continue to be a software engineer, and I thought my career was going to be a software engineer. And I was just excited to work at a security product company. But I was kind of running into all the challenges you have when you're like 22, 23, and you work at like a mega corp like HP, and it's 300,000 people, and everything moves really slowly. And even if you get what they ask you to get done for the day, you maybe you're bored and you build something else and you're like, hey, I think we should put this in the product. And they say, yeah, we won't be able to release that for about 18 to 24 months. It's not in the roadmap. And it's like, oh man, the competition's going to pass us up. They did. But I decided I was ready for a change and I wanted to try to be a professional pen tester. And fortunately, the founder of that company and my mentor there, who was the head of research, he had said, you know what, if I had to build a team of like top five best pen testers in the world, this guy Vinny would be on the team. So you should talk to him. And that's how I got introduced to Bishop Fox. And I was employee number 8. That was about 13 years ago. So been there ever since.
Wow. You don't look hardly old enough to have been as far in your career as you have, but thanks. That's pretty awesome. When you mentioned Web Inspect, that was a familiar name because my second consulting job as a pen tester, the company I worked for then for our web app, for our DAST, we're using Web Inspect. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I was working on the code for that back in the day.
That's a cool story, especially your beginnings, the 2600 meetups and stuff. You know, that for a lot of people listening, you know, those were the predominant meetups before the local DEF CON groups. So you didn't see very many local DEF CON groups earlier on. There's more of them now, but here in Dallas, we've got like a 2600 meetup group because I remember seeing one of the advertisements in one of the 2600 magazines years ago. But that's a pretty cool way to start out, and I bet you're probably a really good CTF builder too.
Yeah,
working building all those vulnerable apps.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I've participated in some CTFs. I've helped contribute some challenges to some that we've done over the years, and I really think it's a great way to learn. I wish there were more CTFs when I was starting out. I think that was like they were relatively rare back then. I think it's amazing now that you can find so many ways to practice your hacking skills legally, and in fact, you can even get incentivized these days. I think like bug bounty is a great way to learn. I think that CTFs are a great way to learn as well.
It's really good. I think some people don't give CTFs enough credit because when then you hear some people that put down the OSCP certification, they'll say it's CTF-like. But one of the things that I think it's a good experience anyway is if it's CTF-like, it's more difficult than what it's like in the real world based on my observations going through the OSCP. If you saw certain things, you would probably be able to exploit that system and get in. But just because you see something doesn't necessarily mean it's vulnerable. They can take you down rabbit trails.
Totally. I couldn't agree more. Actually, OSCP is probably the certification I have the most respect for because it is CTF like. It is it's prove it. Prove that you can hack. It's not pass like a true or false test, which I feel like if anyone studies enough, they can pass one of those. And it's not even a multiple choice. It is like you have to pass this challenge, which is hack these systems, and it's time limited, and you either do it or you don't. And I think that's one of the best ways, I think, to certify someone in this industry.
So yeah, and for the folks listening, you know, Rob's been at his organization for a while, so he's interviewed a lot of people and you know, hiring people. So this is good information to hear. Some people share their opinion sometimes, but maybe their experience has been as an employee. This has helped with that. But so you're getting the words right from a hiring manager on what you need.
Yeah, we actually adapted from a CTF that one of our one of my coworkers, that he's actually his name is Joe. He leads our red team now, but early on he built a CTF, and we actually repurposed some of the challenges into our interview process at Bishop Fox. We called it CloudBox. It's like a Dropbox style web application that lets you upload files and download files and share files. And part of the interview challenge, it was here, hack CloudBox. And We, depending on the seniority of the candidate, we may say like, here, you can have the source code, or you want to do it without source code. But there's some pretty esoteric vulnerabilities in there. It was not just the basics, and we really would evaluate a candidate seniority based on how effective they were in finding those issues, because it's really the only way to know. You have to ask someone to prove that they can do this, and they have to show you. Kind of just talking about it doesn't cut it. Depends on what you want to do in the industry. There's a lot of things that you can do where you spend a lot more time talking about things. But if you want to be a penetration tester, you have to practice. You have to be persistent. I think just not giving up in whatever your objective is, and adapting and overcoming whatever challenges in front of you, and asking for help and having mentors, and all of those are more of a recipe for success if you're really passionate about getting into this line of work.
I really think those are great ways to interview people with the practical type of challenges, because, you know, there's a lot of people that are really technical that don't do well under social pressure. So if they're getting drilled a bunch of questions by someone, they may get nervous. And I think as a hiring manager or interviewer, that you're doing yourself an injustice and missing out on some talent when you're just basing it on that, because some people don't do well under pressure and have a hard time remembering those things. But at least when you give someone a hands-on challenge, you get a better idea what they can do. And sometimes people can't explain certain things, but they can do certain things.
Totally. And I think that one of the really challenging things with consulting and professional services as a form of delivering penetration testing is it is time limited. It is, you know, you're typically paid hourly, and your customers of a penetration testing firm have limited budgets. It's just a reality of the way things work. And there will be a start date, and there will be an end date, and there will be a lot of goals and objectives and methodologies to follow between those two dates. And there'll be blockers, and there'll be a million other challenges sometimes. But how well you roll with those punches probably dictates how successful you are. So it's not for everybody. I think that some people are much happier in like a security engineering role, where they don't have the kind of time constraints and scope restraints and budget constraints that may be imposed on a consultant. So being in-house security engineer is also like a great path to explore if you don't think you'd like the pressure of a consulting. But I actually recommend it. I recommend everyone be a consultant at least for some period of time. You don't have to do it for as long as have if you don't like it, but it forces you to learn a lot. It forces you to manage your time, to manage expectations with others, to work in teams really well, to optimize, and always striving to be more consistent and efficient and transparent with everything that you're doing. I think it's funny. I've seen like people come in from other parts of the industry where they've come in from like an in-house red team or in-house security engineering role, and they've never had to define a scope or like an estimation of effort. Do this, get this done in 9 months. Yeah. Like there's not a real high pressure deadline. So they didn't have to make as much of a project plan. They just had to get it done by like the end of the year.
Yeah, that's a kind of a big shift, because I went in the opposite direction, because my first 5 years of pen testing was working for consulting companies, and I went to work for a bank, and what I would have had in consulting to do in a week, we had like 3 or 4 weeks to do the same thing. And the bad thing is if you're the person in that role that's going to go the other way, it's going to be kind of a wake up when you get in somewhere else. Yeah, you got a week to do that, and used to doing it in a week.
Yeah.
But you kind of learn, it's almost like learning in dog years.
Yeah.
I mean, because, you know, a dog for every year, they age like 7 or whatever, like equal to humans or whatever. So just the amount of time, you know, I have to agree with you that I really agree with starting with consulting, because all those different environments you get to touch, because you don't get to see all that stuff in one environment in most cases.
Yeah. I think there's, I actually want to come back to that point, because you made me think of something really interesting. And sorry if you can hear sirens in the background. I live in San Francisco. Okay. So,
and Rob's not doing anything illegal. He had permission to hack what he's hacking into. So they're not coming after him.
I swear I'm not sweating with those sirens. They're probably not for me. The point you bring up about like you went the opposite way to a bank. I've heard that story like many times. Like actually a good friend of mine, he just went from, he's kind of worked for a few different like big four consulting groups, which are super high pressure. And then he went to work for a very large, like Fortune 50 company. And, he said he is just shocked at the lack of urgency to get things done compared to what he was used to. But I think that, as we evolve, offensive, security testing, I really hope that we can eliminate, time constraints more and more from, our objectives, because I think real attackers, while you could argue that real attackers do have budgets and deadlines and bosses, I do think it's very different than how consulting services and professional services have applied their technique to deliver testing and red teaming, penetration testing, whatever it may be. I just think there's a big disparate difference between the way that the 30-year-old pattern of how like the Ernst & Young handbook said to scope and deliver a pen test. It's not how real attackers do it. It's not at all. And I think that if we want to get better at practicing for the fight that we're in, whether we realize it or not in cybersecurity, we should probably spar with our attackers the same way that they are attacking us. So I think there's a lot we can do to evolve.
Yeah, I agree. And there's so much, one of the things I see in the industry working inside of companies, I'm sure you deal with that a lot as a consultant, is how people don't understand that area. I mean, I worked at a company for a while that I was a red team lead, and a lot of the people in security didn't know the difference between a vulnerability assessment, a vulnerability scan, a pen test, or a red team operation. I had a director that wouldn't listen to me, that he wanted a red team operation done against an SAP application.
All right. The first thing that I'll always do when I talk to a prospective customer, even an existing customer, is if they ask for a red team versus a pen test versus a vuln assessment, is you have to ask that individual, what do you mean by that? Just so that we're all speaking the same language. And often I get very different answers from different people. So even within our industry is so immature still. I truly believe it is compared to other industries, especially when it comes to understanding terminology and nomenclature. And especially as we evolve what it means to perform, you know, security testing, I think that everyone has a bit of their own definition in their head. So it's really important to set expectations whenever someone tells you they want a red team, to ask them, what do you mean by that? And what are the outcomes that you expect? And you'll probably get a much better understanding at that point.
Yeah, that's the misunderstandings of that is just amazing, you know, because that's one of the things I'll tell people and places I work. I try to correct people and say, you know, red teaming is adversary emulation. It's not just a pen test. It's been pen testing and just generalized. And I've seen people on, some people want it to be that way because, I mean, it kind of makes it sound cooler, red teaming compared to pen testing in some cases. And a while back, Jason Haddix had shared on Twitter, you know, red teaming doesn't equal pen testing and all that. And someone came up that was, you know, a pen tester, a bug bounty hunter that tried to argue it was, but that's not the case. Things get generalized, and I don't know where this comes from. I don't think it's so much consultancies. I think it's probably people, you know, internal pen testers and companies, either that or some company comes out with some kind of product or something, not necessarily the people that really know the industry.
Yeah.
So for our, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to add to that, like, words are really important. And if for anyone that wants to get into this industry or is just looking to improve themselves in this line of work, words are very important. Learning how to communicate well, learning how to write. I felt like I was a terrible writer. I still feel like I'm a terrible writer, to be perfectly honest. But I feel like I was really bad at writing when I first got into pen testing. And you'll probably also hear a lot of people say that the worst part of the job is writing the report, which is true. But I had some really good mentors. Actually, Carl on our team, who was one of my first mentors when I first joined on at Bishop Fox. He's from Scotland and has a great accent and just compels people that are listening to him talk about anything really, but especially when he starts telling you hacking stories, you're really sucked in. But he's also was one of the best writers I'd ever met and just really great at written communication and really precise and hinged on every word that was in my report. And it would be covered in red lines whenever he would QA one of my reports. Making sure that I really put myself in the shoes of the audience so that they could have enough information to really understand what I was trying to tell them. And we also always just really hinged on demonstrating business impact in everything we did. So if we found a vulnerability, that wasn't enough. Like, we had to show the impact of that vulnerability to give our reader of our report some sense of the priority that it deserves. And I really think that that's what helped make the reputation of Bishop Fox what it is. It is that focus on impact and that focus on helping people have the evidence that they needed to motivate people to fix the issues that we were reporting. And the best way to do that is to make impact.
That's good. And that's one of the things too, to be able to, you know, tell the story that way that the business folks understand, because sometimes they don't understand the technical jargon. So if they don't know what a SQL injection is or what this or that is, but when you show them what it could do to their business and what leads to it, you know, information, people get a hold of information, or, you know, business risk, money loss, then they start to understand that, and it makes it easier to justify the remediation too.
Yeah, something that I had to learn how to do early on was go deliver like an executive outbrief. So we would do our pen test, we would write our report, we'd deliver the report, we'd have our main stakeholders and points of contact. We typically would do like a readout session with them, but sometimes they would want us to give an executive outbrief, which was essentially a presentation to their management. And you're totally right. Like, the management didn't know what a SQL injection was, and they frankly didn't care. And they didn't want some young looking kid to come in and tell them about what a SQL injection vulnerability is. All they cared about is what was the impact of the business, and what did they need to know about that, and what did they need to do about it to fix it, either from like a tactical perspective or a strategic perspective. That was challenging for me, because I mean, early on, I did look pretty young walking into those rooms, and it was pretty intimidating sometimes. And I had, you know, people challenge me, but I was always just able to stick to the facts. And the fact was, we hacked the organization. And the fact was, we had the evidence, and we, could show in our analysis, not only was there SQL injection, but there we were able to download 14,377 records that contain social security numbers and credit card numbers in plain text. And the value of those would be approximately this on like the black market if an attacker were going to sell them. So they're pretty motivated to steal those. And the cost of a data breach, according to like Ponemon Institute, would be, you know, about $278 per record, and times 14,000, you know, we're looking at a pretty hefty multi-million dollar breach here.
Yeah, when you start speaking the numbers, and the funny thing is, I recently went to work for a company, and, you know, working with marketing folks and the sales teams, you kind of get to see what those people feel like when we're not translating well enough, because when people are talking about KPIs and MQLs, and when I hear SQL, I'm thinking SQL and, you know, Microsoft SQL or some type of structured query language database. But you kind of get to, you know, it's kind of got to see recently what the people are thinking, what's running through their heads when they're hearing all this alphabet soup of acronyms coming from us if they're not that technical or really understand what we're doing.
Yeah. At the end of the day, like, they have a business to run, and I think the good news is, getting a penetration test is requirement now and for running most businesses, especially if they deal with sensitive PHI or PII or financial data. Each industry has its regulations. And I'm really happy to see that the industry's also evolved into, there's a lot more people that actually do just care from a due diligence perspective, and they understand cyber attacks are a very real threat, and it's probably not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, and that they're going to have to deal with some incident or breach, and they want to bring on experts that can really help them get prepared for that. And the other thing that I'm excited for is I think that there is a lot of folks out there that want access to this type of expertise more frequently than once a year, which is unfortunately what a lot of the requirements state for now. I think there's already starting to be some requirements and compliances that I think the NYDFS, there's starting to add some language that if you need to... Or if you're going to do business with a financial institution that in the state of New York, which at that point pretty much includes every financial institution, you have to do continuous testing. And I think that this is where we'll see the direction go for this industry. Doing testing once a year just doesn't cut it, because attackers don't just come at you once a year. They are coming at you continuously. There are opportunistic attackers scanning the entire internet every day, and they don't necessarily care what your organization does or who you are, but they will hunt for every instance of a vulnerability, of the latest missing patch, latest CVE, or maybe they're looking for every instance of a sensitive info leak or misconfiguration. And they will just compromise that system. They will breach that system because they can maybe sell it to a ransomware gang as an initial access vector. Maybe they can add it to their botnet. Maybe they can use it for cryptocurrency mining. Maybe they just put it, save it for a rainy day and go look and see where they're at later, and continue to land and expand and do post-exploitation until they get to more sensitive data, if there wasn't something juicy on that first box that they compromised. So I think all of that alone is enough for us to try to explore ways to do opportunistic style analysis on a regular basis, and try to find any indicators of exposure or indicators of vulnerability that are exposed on the attack surface of an organization, and then go see if those are exploitable, and help organizations prioritize fixing them.
Yeah, and it seems it's even a bigger risk when you really think about over the past 5 or 10 years, at least the past 5 years, the threat actors have really figured out how to monetize these attacks. And one time, it was really kind of hard for them to make money, but they really figured out how to do it, either selling the data or using ransomware or something else.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of that stuff has been pretty game changer in just how much more money attackers can earn. And there are a lot of criminals that are very motivated by money. So that just, I think, increases the stakes for the organizations that need to protect themselves. And it probably shifts how much they should be spending to protect themselves. And so I think that we will see continued investment and increases in investment, perhaps even while the economy is on a downturn compared to the last few years before the pandemic. But because I tend to notice a trend that organizations want to protect what they have whenever they do see risk just in the ecosystem and the global economy. I think they maybe invest more in insecurity and managing risk than they do in growing and innovation and hiring and things like that.
Yes, great thoughts there. We're getting down kind of towards the end of the show, so I wanted to see what would your advice be for someone that wanted to get into pen testing, someone who wanted to be a pen tester. What would be your path for recommended path for someone wanting to get into the industry?
I'd say at this point, find someone that you admire, find someone that you look up to in the industry. Maybe you read something they wrote. Maybe you watched one of their conference talks. Maybe you used a tool, an open source tool that they've made. And reach out to that person. Don't be shy. Send them a really polite message, a really well thought out message. You know, thank them for their impact on you, and ask them a question. Just ask them maybe some questions that you'd like to learn more about from them. And I have a feeling that when they have time, they will get back to you and they will answer you. And if you want to get into penetration testing, absolutely do CTFs, absolutely do bug bounty. I know you may think that there's a big hurdle and barrier of entry to maybe you're not understanding a lot of the terms that you're reading about, or the techniques or the tools or the procedures that you're seeing other people use. That just becomes your homework. That becomes your set of goals, and that becomes your to-do list to go read up on those and practice and get hands-on. Don't just read about it. You have to get hands-on. You have to get fingers on keyboard. And I would say learn as much as you can about these systems. I think that maybe you're more interested in networking, or maybe you're more interested in application development, or maybe you're interested in how cloud systems work, or maybe you really take a liking to elements like social engineering, or there's a lot to learn in this industry, and figure out what you're most passionate about. And you're allowed to change your mind on that. You can be passionate about one thing for a few months, and then I change my mind all the time. I have like very a variety of interests, but go and just get hands-on with whatever you're most passionate about, and don't give up until you have achieved the goals that you set out for yourself.
Great advice. Always like hearing people's advice on how to get into the industry, and that's some pretty unique advice there. So thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to join me today.
Absolutely. I'm really glad that we were able to do this today, and I hope to keep chatting with you.
And for everyone out there, we'll share Rob's Twitter account, so you can follow Rob on Twitter and connect with him. So thanks everyone for joining, and we'll see you on the next episode.
BugCrowd's award-winning platform combines actionable contextual intelligence with the skill and experience of the world's most elite hackers to help leading organizations identify and fix vulnerabilities, protect customers, and make the digitally connected world a safer place. Learn more at bugcrowd.com.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hacker Factory podcast with Philip Wiley. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share itsbmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.